Does that First Amendment cover our right to read, to learn, to discuss the news of the day in the classroom? You're listening to the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer Kenton, what happens after we ban the books and make academic theories illegal? We're asking the ACLU of Wisconsin and you this morning at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Melinda Brennan, took over as executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin in January. Born and raised in Port Washington, Melinda earned her bachelor's and master's degree at UW-Milwaukee. Melinda, good morning and welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with how you see your priorities for the ACLU in Wisconsin going forward.
Well, we have a lot of priorities and a very large platform, but really, if you're going to ask me what the priorities are, it's being in service to the communities of Wisconsin. And in particular, you just mentioned censorship and not being able to have meaningful conversations and dialogues across difference. And I think that's got to be one of the top priorities, maintaining our freedom of speech.
So can you see the other side of that argument, though, of why people would look towards infringing that speech or why they would look to protect from that speech?
Well, I would phrase it this way. If we're unable to have conversations about things that are incredibly important to us, then there's no way for us to come together on other issues. If we can't be informed via facts or any number of other conversations that are ongoing in our culture, I'm not sure how we're preparing children or the adults for more conversations and political debate. I think to restrict and to utilize censorship as a weapon of governmental overreach only infringes on everyone's rights. And so, unfortunately, I can't see the other side of the argument because I'd rather preserve the right for everyone.
So what does that do in regards to hate speech then? Where does that put hate speech in the context of our rights to free speech?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. Nobody's free speech should supersede or interfere with another person's pursuit of their own rights, liberties, or dignity. And hate speech is not actually covered. It's a violation of the freedom of expression because it's meant to be able to hurt and incite violence. And so freedom of speech is wide-ranging, and it's something that we should all avail ourselves of. But the moment when it becomes meant to rob someone of their dignity or to cause harm to that person, well, then that's no longer covered. And so I think not only K-12, but on college campuses, we need to be very careful about how we're thinking about how we maintain our communities, how we have robust dialogue, how people are able best to explore all kinds of topics, and to do so with respect to each other, because we are actually able to accomplish that if we try.
Wasn't there just a UW-Milwaukee panel discussion on this?
There was. The VP of our board, Angela Lang, who's also the executive director of Block, was asked to do a keynote at UWM. There's a series called, I believe, Difficult Conversations or Difficult Dialogues. There's a panel formed of students from across a number of different backgrounds, sometimes with competing ideas. And I think that the whole point of that series is actually excellent because what it does is it models behavior for everyone in the audience, whether they're students, community members, people from campus, and they get to discuss openly and without reservation their ideas on an issue without the fear of people taking attacks at each other on the panel or from the audience. And they get to have a robust dialogue that hopefully leads to some greater understanding or a more thoughtful, promised conversation of the future. And one of the things that was a takeaway for me from that conversation was there's the kind of work that I'm doing now, which at the ACLU, we're talking about the freedom of speech and we're talking about where that line ends in relation to hate speech. But there are also practical considerations on a college campus, for example. And just because you might have the freedom of speech to say terrible things that are not necessarily violent, that they don't trip over into the hate speech component, it doesn't mean that we as community members don't owe it to each other to do our very best to keep everybody involved in the conversation and to do so with dignity.
Melinda Brennan, our guest. She's the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. What do you know about the mission of the ACLU? Has the organization defended positions which you agree or don't agree with? 1-800-642-1234 to join us or email ideas at WPR.org. Where does the term cancel culture fit in with all this as you see it, Melinda Brennan? As comedian Louis C.K. performed in my backyard in Madison earlier this year, received a Grammy last night, and yet he was one that we were told would be canceled as part of this cancel culture. Does that term mean anything to you in the ACLU?
Well, let me first answer just as me without my ACLU hat on. Okay. I am not personally a fan of cancel culture. And the reason is I'd rather have conversation. I would rather be able to hold people accountable, but still remain engaged in conversation. And for me, cancel culture literally means one side becomes so loud that the other can't speak at all. And I'm not sure that other than in very limited applications, that's helpful. Let me give you an example. If, for example, we're talking about cancel culture by trying to hold a company or a very large organization accountable by saying over and over again, we'd like you to address X and we don't believe you have adequately. That's one thing, but that's calling someone to account. That's not necessarily cancel culture because you're hoping that they'll respond.
It's consequences. What I don't,
right. Consequences and accountability. I'm all for those kinds of things. But if it's about foreclosing conversation and dialogue, there are a few circumstances under which I think that is incredibly helpful, but they're few. Otherwise, I would much rather pull someone to the side if it's an individual and say, hey, you know, you said something, and I'm going to speak from my own personal perspective here and say it made me really uncomfortable for these reasons. And I'd like you to just go forward thinking about that. I would much rather preserve relationships, bring as many community members to the table on an issue as I possibly can, because I think that benefits us all. So that's my my personal, as a longtime educator, take on cancel culture, that it has limited a limited ability to achieve its objectives. In terms of the ACLU, I don't think the ACLU has a particular view on cancel culture. I think the answer really has to be it's a matter of freedom of speech. So people should be free to express their speech from government intervention or overreach. And so that doesn't really weigh in on how we should be treating each other so we continue to engage in dialogue.
Melinda Brennan, our guest, Executive Director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. Your questions at 1-800-642-1234. The ACLU also works with undocumented folks here in Wisconsin, undocumented workers and victims of discrimination. That sort of advocacy is not easy, Melinda. So how does the ACLU decide when to take up these cases?
Well, I'll take a moment and say that we have a fantastic legal department, and some of their work that you're pointing towards is incredibly sensitive. We've got more requests than we could ever hope to answer to because of, well, real human limitations. There's only so many people on the team and so many hours in the day. So we very carefully vet the cases that come to us. Sometimes people come to us and sometimes we go to them. And we try to imagine what is the likely outcome. Can we do the most good for the most people by taking on a case? And that's why it's called impact litigation. If only I had an endless budget, I think we'd do an even more good job of taking on as many cases as possible. But there are some cases that are incredibly sensitive, particularly cases that have been informed by violence. As you suggest, whether it's governmental violence or whether it's interpersonal violence. And I would add to that as well, you didn't put it in your list, but folks that have been violated in their engagement with the carceral system. And so we think very carefully about how we can take on a case, do right by the person who came to us, who gave us the case, as well as what's the largest impact we can hope to get from this case. And so we do the work as ethically as we possibly can with vigorous debate, not only in-house, but with our partners at ACLU National, as well as any number of coalition partners in our community.
So Wisconsin's not among 30 states with laws protecting pregnant workers who require health-related accommodations. I'm wondering if the ACLU of Wisconsin is playing any role in dealing with this issue.
Well, this is what I'll say to you. I'm not going to comment on individual cases that may or may not be ongoing, but this is what I'll say. I have been a person who has been fighting for other people for a very long time. And whether that means advocating for them or uplifting their voices, opening doors, or having vigorous debate. People who are being treated badly because of one element or factor in their life, who may be marginalized, who are being actively discriminated against, that's the ACLU wheelhouse, as well as my own personal lifelong commitment. So if there are folks that are being treated very badly because of an element in their life, for example, pregnancy being weaponized against them, I think that they should have a right to have great representation and have their voices heard in the public sphere.
Melinda Brennan took over the role as executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin at the beginning of the year. You've already taken your hat off once. And I'm wondering, are there times where you understand the bigger picture of the ACLU and its work that it's doing, but you could disagree with certain items or things?
Oh, certainly. And I think any number of us, I think a lot of folks who are in whatever you'd like to call them, whether they're social justice organizations or community-centered organizations, I think all of us understand that we might have a moment of pause when we're debating how we best handle an issue and whether or not we can take on a case, what our lane is. I think if we're going to be honest, all of us have those moments where we're trying to figure out what's best given our role. And so there can be moments where I take my hat off and I scratch my head and I say, well, if I was but a single person, but I'm not, because I'm representing as many of the platform interests as I can at any one time. And so, yes, I am a full human as well. But on the other hand, I am representing the ACLU of Wisconsin, our platform, our communities, and folks that need us. And I always have to pivot in that direction at the end of the day.
Melinda Brennan, our guest, executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, and taking your questions this morning at 1-800-642-1234. Have you been involved in a free speech or a civil rights case taken up by the ACLU? What was your experience? Are you or is someone you know an undocumented worker who sought representation from the ACLU attorneys? Join us, ideas at WPR.org or 1-800-642-1234. And our conversation with Melinda Brennan continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. Your State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is the new leader of the ACLU of Wisconsin. And while we have this time together, what would you like to know about your civil liberties and what the ACLU in our state would do to protect them? 1-800-642-1234 to join us, or email ideas at WPR.org. Melinda Brennan, the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, stays with us. And Melinda, elections across the state will be held tomorrow. Republicans and Democrats battling in court over rules around the use of ballot drop boxes, absentee ballots. What do you want voters to know before they go to the polls tomorrow?
I want them to be able to vote. I want them to feel free from governmental intervention to stop them from voting. I want them to not be confused by having drop boxes, ballot boxes taken away from them during an election cycle. I think that was an incredibly unethical maneuver to disturb the cycle of an election so that people were more likely to be confused and less likely to vote. And so if I'm asking something of folks, I would ask them to make sure that they exercise their right to vote, because everyone should have that right uninfringed.
Yeah. And are voting rights a concern for the ACLU? And if so, how does it fit in the bigger picture?
Well, right now, if I'm talking about Wisconsin particularly and battleground states in general, I would say that one of my greatest concerns is voting rights. Voting rights impact every other issue that's part of the dedicated platform of the ACLU nationally, as well as in the state of Wisconsin. I want people to be well-educated voters who know who their candidates are, feel free to ask them questions, are held accountable in public, but most importantly, that the rules are not changed mid-game so that people know how to exercise those rights to vote.
Melinda, much of your academic work, as I understand it, was sociology, women's and gender studies. You wrote your doctoral dissertation on white supremacy and Islamophobia. Wow. Just give us some idea about your background and how that paints your view as you step into your role as the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin.
Well, I'll say something that's often repeated in women's and gender studies classrooms as well as ethnic studies classrooms, and that's that your personal history greatly informs your worldview, and that your worldview is already political. And so for me, I come from and back home to a number of different kinds of communities, some of which are marginalized. And so part of my, I guess, advocacy all the way up until this moment has been thinking about what my role is in relation to a particular issue or community. And sometimes that means that I'm the one that opens the door and stands at the mic because I'm an impacted person. And sometimes that means, especially in this role, I get to open the door, grab the microphone, and pass it to someone who's less likely to be heard.
And Melinda, as you mentioned, not an attorney, and yet a lot of the work that the ACLU of Wisconsin does has a legal component. Is it common for a leader of a state chapter to not be an attorney? And so how do you work with the attorneys on your team?
Well, I'll say this. There are a lot of different pathways to becoming executive director of an ACLU affiliate. One of them is as coming up as an attorney and becoming the legal director and then eventually taking over the executive director seat. There are a number of other pathways. And I'll say this, I'm not a person who likes to brag, but I'm very well read. But better than that is I'm always a student. And so I have a lot to learn in all kinds of areas. And I appreciate the knowledge of subject matter experts. And so I'm a constant learner. But being in this chair means that I have to listen to all the best information and at the very end of the day, call the play. And sometimes that means consulting with lots and lots of people. And sometimes it's one excellent argument, and it's very clear that that's the most ethical thing to do.
And talking about how your background paints your worldview from your academic standpoint, but what about your background in Wisconsin? You're growing up in Port Washington, going to school at UW-Milwaukee. How does that paint the way you see your role leading the ACLU of Wisconsin, Melinda?
Well, sure. Well, I'll say this. My family is originally, well, we're from a lot of places, but my family long-term has been from the south side of Milwaukee historically. I am the first person in my family to attend and graduate from college on one side. I am the first person certainly to get a master's in my family, a doctorate. My grandma, I think, had maybe a fourth or fifth grade education. We're not quite sure. And worked in factories her entire life and asked of her two daughters, please become educated because education was everything. And of course, that was passed down to me, and I took that very seriously. And I would say that my own personal experience squares with that because I was able to have conversations about who I was and see representation of myself, sometimes for the very first time in higher education. And so I think it's incredibly powerful to be able to have access to unrestricted conversations and voices that are less likely to be heard. And I think that should happen a lot earlier in the lives of students.
Melinda Brennan, our guest, executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, answering your questions about the role and direction of the ACLU of Wisconsin going forward at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Do you still hold true to that axiom, Melinda, that education is everything?
Yes, I absolutely do. But I would broaden the idea of education. I would say that it's not just formalized education, because formalized education always will pivot towards power. It's a system and it's created by the government. And so that means that disproportionately the voices within education are going to be somewhat more privileged than others. And so I would say that experiential education is incredibly important. Personal knowledge is incredibly important. And we should be able to put all kinds of different knowledge together and on the table to figure out what's best given a community dialogue.
So that sort of brings us full circle, Melinda, when you talk about the power of the systems behind education and the need to get education other, not just in the classroom, but in life and in the streets. So some parents and legislators in Wisconsin are seeking to limit how race and sexuality are taught in public schools. Where does the ACLU stand on removing books from school curriculum or banning teaching subjects such as critical race theory?
Absolutely unacceptable and literally governmental overreach. How are students supposed to become better informed if they can't have conversations about race? Explain to me how students who are young students of color never see representation. How will that benefit them? To say that race or to frame that race and gender and sexuality are divisive concepts is literally oppressive and censorship, which does nothing to handle the kinds of conversations that we need to have going forward and reforms. So by labeling the thing itself that we should be discussing as divisive, it's an end run around governmental overreach. And quite frankly, it's a dishonest framing of the entire conversation. We should have more access, greater access to more difficult conversations. And we shouldn't target various communities, communities of color, LGBTQ plus students. We shouldn't be targeting them with a silencing, a chilling effect, saying, well, we don't want to talk about you. Your life isn't valuable to us. It shouldn't be part of formalized education. That is just unacceptable to the ACLU, as well as I think a lot of parents who want robust conversation and education for their students and to see them represented and to feel pride in the education system.
Let's go to your calls at 1-800-642-1234, where Tom and Glenn Flora are standing by. Tom, you're on the air with Melinda Brennan, the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin.
Good morning. I have a question. Does the ACLU ever get involved in defending constitutional rights that are beyond civil liberties, as we traditionally think, such as speech and religion and so on? Does the ACLU ever get involved in constitutional issues beyond civil rights?
Melinda?
Absolutely. First up on my mind is thinking about privacy and surveillance. For example, what tools can the police utilize in order to surveil, but to do so within the rights that we all have? That's one conversation. That's a national conversation that is not immediately tracked to marginalized people. But I would say that the way that surveillance often gets utilized is a nexus between civil rights and civil liberties, because we know that folks of color, particularly Black folks, are often surveilled far more than others.
Hey, Melinda Brennan, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Melinda Brennan is the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, taking over that role in January. Just ahead, what happens when climate change renders neighborhoods and whole communities unlivable? We talked to Wisconsin officials who know because they've helped relocate their residents. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent today, and you've been listening to the State Capitol Report this week, every Monday morning starting at 7 here on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.